Hello and welcome to Volume 44, Number 51 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine, and welcome to our Christmas special. Yes, brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 20th of December 2024. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by all your friends from the Grapevine News teams, with Margaret and Dusty doing news duty. And in the news this week, more on exploding fertiliser, bin collecting details, Galston Town FC are going home, and the JPH's pet cat. Plus, of course, loads of special Christmas bits and pieces from all of Grapevine's familiar voices. First, though, we have a birthday. Yes, it's a special hello for a great day next Friday, the 27th, to Helen Godbolt. Many happy returns, Helen. Yes, you don't get away without having that played at you. Well, it may be Christmas, but good or bad, the news never stops. So across to Margaret for the first part.
Hello everyone, it's Margaret here again. And this week we welcome a new listener. So it's welcome to Mrs. Jean Carter. And Jean, I hope you'll enjoy listening to your recordings each week. Now, can I take this opportunity to wish all of you a very happy and peaceful Christmas? And if 2024 hasn't been good for you, then I really hope that 2025 will be better. And I'm sending special greetings to Thelma of Bradwell from the two convent school girls. Thelma, you know who we are. Anyway, enough of my meanderings. And I'll begin with the first part of the news. Yarmouth on verge of evacuation. Officials discussed plans to evacuate Great Yarmouth, fearing a damaged cargo ship with 20,000 tonnes of fertiliser might explode, with one expert warning the town could be flattened, the EDP can now reveal. The possibility was raised by public agencies dealing with the MV Ruby, which arrived in Norfolk carrying more than seven times the amount of ammonium nitrate which devastated Beirut in an explosion in 2020. The Maltese-flagged vessel had suffered storm damage while sailing from Russia to the Canary Islands and docked in Yarmouth in October, having reportedly been refused permission to enter Lithuanian and Swedish waters. UK experts were concerned that some of the cargo may have been contaminated with seawater and fuel oil as a result of the damage, increasing the risk that it might have become unstable and liable to explode. It meant the ship's arrival prompted days of extraordinary negotiation and discussion among UK safety and transport agencies, the port company as well as the local council, over what to do with the cargo. Details of these have now been revealed in a dossier compiled by Rupert Lowe, the Yarmouth MP. He has described the handling of the situation as a scandal and believes the authorities overreacted. He has called for the organisations involved to give more details about what happened and why. The saga eventually ended when the 300 tonnes of the cargo, which were believed to be contaminated, were dumped in the sea off the town. Mr. Lowe believes this was unnecessary, has described it as an environmental terrorism. The MP, who plans to raise the matter in the House of Commons this week, said, "We want to know how close Yarmouth was to being evacuated. I think plans to evacuate were much closer than we realise, perhaps a matter of minutes. Mr. Lowe is angered that he was not kept informed of the situation while it was unfolding, but has pieced together the details from speaking to some of those involved. Among the findings of his dossier are that a no-fly zone over Great Yarmouth was imposed by the Transport Secretary. Evacuation plans were discussed with Health and Safety Executive, HSE, calculations used to identify blast zones to assess the likely impact of damage on the town and which areas needed to be cleared. Around 30,000 people would have been evacuated under the plans. The HSE and Peel Ports, which runs Great Yarmouth Port, were in dispute over whether the potentially contaminated fertiliser, which was stored in vast bags, should be removed from the ship's hold onto the quayside. One HSE expert is said to have rejected this proposed solution, advising that if a bag was accidentally dropped during the unloading, it may explode. Those present in the meeting said the expert claimed the cargo could flatten the town. However, a leaked video shows that while the cargo was being dumped at sea, a crane cable snapped, dropping a bag into the hold of the ship with no explosion. During the final operation to jettison the apparently contaminated fertiliser, around 12 miles off the coast, an aircraft from the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency monitored the operation overhead. Mr. Lowe's dossier said the plan had originally been to remove the material from the bags, but in the end this was not considered possible and it was dumped in the containers. At least one is said to have resurfaced after being lowered into the sea. Mr. Lowe said there were questions to answer about the environmental impact of the disposal, which has caused deep anger among the fishing industry and conservationists. The dossier gives a timeline of the saga, which began with the vessel arriving on October the 28th, pulled by tugboats with damage to its hull and propeller. Peel Ports agreed to allow the vessel, nicknamed a floating megabomb during its time in Norfolk, to dock as it was confident it had the facilities to deal with the cargo. However, it was during the offloading process on November the 11th that seawater staining was seen on the outside of some of the container bags, prompting concerns that the material inside could have been contaminated. Ammonium nitrate is not inherently explosive and is managed safely at ports across the world. However, contamination increases the likelihood of an explosion in the result of a fire or shock. The addition of diesel fuel produces a mix called ANFO, ammonium nitrate fuel oil, one of the most widely used explosives. As well as seawater, there were concerns that the Ruby's ammonium nitrate had been contaminated with fuel oil from the damaged ship. The explosion of around 2,750 tonnes of ammonium nitrate in Beirut in August 2020, which left at least 218 dead, was triggered by a fire, but wider safety problems with its storage were also blamed. Following the discovery of the potential contamination on the Ruby, the issue was dramatically escalated. A strategic coordinating group was set up using COBRA procedures, the processes used to coordinate the government response to major crises. It included representatives from the various agencies. On November the 14th, the then Transport Secretary Louise Haig ordered a no-fly zone over Great Yarmouth. The issues were discussed over the course of various meetings, with plans for potential evacuation of the town on the weekend of November the 16th and the 17th drawn up. The document states evacuation plans were discussed, including blast zones from HSE calculations. The ship was thought capable of killing or injuring 30,000 people and destroying three quarters of all buildings within 3 miles. This worst-case scenario was considered a theoretically low probability. However, Mr. Lowe's dossier singles out one HSE expert present at the meetings who is accused of creating panic by his attitude, behaviour, and also citing that this will flatten Great Yarmouth. One witness said the expert created absolute panic, adding, "His attitude and way of managing a crisis like this was out of order." The expert was said to have been banging on the table and swearing, telling people this is going to flatten Great Yarmouth. During the discussions, Sheila Oxtoby, the CEO of Great Yarmouth Borough Council, asked on several occasions to brief councillors and Mr. Lowe, but was refused permission. Ultimately, the evacuation plans were shelved and a decision was made to get the material away from the town instead. On November the 15th, the dossier says, the agencies made it clear to the Yarmouth Harbour Master that the Ruby should be considered a dangerous vessel under the 1985 Dangerous Vessels Act, leaving its eviction from the port as the only option. The following day, the ship laid anchor 10 to 12 miles off the coast of Yarmouth and dumped around 300 tonnes of the cargo into the sea. While the cargo was being dumped, Miss Oxtoby was permitted to brief her council leader and deputy leader, but not Mr. Lowe. MV Ruby returned to the port the next day, where the remaining non-contaminated cargo continued to be offloaded. Mr. Lowe said, "It's astonishing that discussions to uproot my constituents were held without informing me. The government should not be able to override and not inform an elected member of parliament about something concerning their constituency as per the Bill of Rights." He claims that ministers have stressed the situation was handled locally. However, local sources have insisted that key decisions were made at a national level. He also accused the HSE of delays in carrying out in-person checks of the apparent contamination, instead relying on remote inspections, therefore allowing the situation to escalate more than it needed to. A spokesman for the HSE said, "It's not HSE's role to inspect cargo on a ship or sample ammonium nitrate. HSE specialists made a technical assessment of risk based on the information provided by Peel Ports." He also said it had provided advice to the port on their duties under health and safety legislation and provided technical support to them and to other government departments. The spokesman added the organisation had not received any complaints about the conduct of inspectors involved in meetings relating to the MV Ruby. The hunt for a wanted man that lasted more than a month has finally come to an end. Liam Whittle, of no fixed abode, was arrested in Great Yarmouth on December the 13th after avoiding law enforcement for 31 days. The 30-year-old was taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre and has been charged on suspicion of drug offences. He appeared at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court today and has been remanded in custody to appear in court at a later date. Whittle was wanted in connection with an assault and failing to answer to bail. And another crime story. A man left householders terrified they might die after throwing petrol around a flat when he was told to leave following a night out, the court has heard. Paul Courtney, 40, forced his way into the home on Middle Market Road in Great Yarmouth before dousing the interior and some of the people inside with petrol. Courtney had gone back to the property following a night out with others, but he was asked to leave by the owner in the early hours of May the 25th this year. Norwich Crown Court heard Courtney then bought cigarettes and a jerry can from a nearby garage before filling it up with £8 worth of petrol, which he left without paying for, prior to the early morning attempted arson attack. Those still in the house at Middle Market Road later heard a loud bang before seeing Courtney throwing petrol on the stairs and inside the property. Oliver Haswell, prosecuting, said those who went to investigate had petrol thrown on them, and some thought they were going to die. Courtney was chased away by some of those present and suffered a very significant assault himself, resulting in him being airlifted to hospital. Mr. Haswell said Courtney's actions had been a spontaneous response to the rejection of not being allowed entry to the address. Courtney, of the street Courton, Lowestoft, appeared at court on Monday, December the 16th, after he admitted attempted arson and being reckless as to whether life was endangered. He also admitted damaging property and theft. Imposing an extended 9-year sentence, Judge Timothy Clayson said, "Multiple people were endangered by your actions and were terrified as to what might happen next." Jonathan Goodman, mitigating, accepted a number of people had been in the property at the time, but insisted there was no evidence the defendant had taken out matches or a lighter to light the petrol. He said Courtney, who knew a custodial sentence was inevitable, had been drunk at the time and was himself subjected to a serious assault. He had also made an attempt on his life a few days prior to the incident and had not been in a good place mentally. And the next item is all about your rubbish. It's Bins Collection Over Christmas 2024. Great Yarmouth Borough Council's Christmas bin collections will last 2 weeks, and the majority of collections will be pushed forward, with 2 days pushed back. So, normal collection day, Tuesday, December the 24th. The festive collection day will be Monday, December the 23rd. Normal collection day, Wednesday, December the 25th. The festive collection day is Tuesday, December the 24th. Normal collection day, Thursday, December the 26th. The festive collection day will be Friday, December the 27th. And normal collection day, Friday, December the 27th. The festive collection day will be Saturday, December the 28th. And then the next week, normal collection day, Tuesday, December the 31st. Festive collection day will be Monday, December the 30th. Normal collection day, Wednesday, January the 1st. The festive collection day will be Tuesday, December the 31st. Normal collection day, Thursday, January the 2nd. The festive collection day will be Thursday, January the 2nd. And normal collection day, Friday, January the 3rd. Festive collection day will be, as normal, Friday, January the 3rd. Five men from Norfolk were among the 11 people sentenced during the following disorder at the East Anglian Derby earlier this year. The incident happened before the football match between Norwich City and Ipswich Town on April the 6th. At about 11:45 a.m. on Heathside Road, Cotman Road, Thorpe Road and Carrow Road in Norwich, police say a group of men were verbally and physically aggressive to each other. 17 men and 3 teenage boys have now appeared in court and entered pleas to various offences, including 5 from Norfolk. Aaron Rolfe, 31, of Kerred Road, Norwich, pleaded guilty to causing fear or provocation of violence and was sentenced to a 12-month community order and ordered to complete 80 hours unpaid work. Sydney Mason, 25, of Brighties Opening, Norwich, pleaded guilty to causing fear or provocation of violence and was sentenced to a 12-month community order and ordered to complete 100 hours unpaid work. Jacob Conley, 18, of Astell Road, Norwich, pleaded guilty to causing fear or provocation of violence. He was sentenced to a 12-month community order and ordered to complete 80 hours unpaid work. Jack Collins, 24, of George Close Bradwell, Great Yarmouth, pleaded guilty to causing fear or provocation of violence and was sentenced to a 12-month community order and 150 hours of unpaid work. Ronnie Oliver, 21, of the Shrublands, Horsford, pleaded guilty to causing fear or provocation of violence and was sentenced to a 12-month community order and ordered to complete 100 hours unpaid work. They were all also ordered to pay £85 in cost, a £114 victim surcharge, and issued with a 4-year football banning order. Investigating Officer PC Elizabeth Palmer said, "I'm hopeful that this case will demonstrate that football violence will not and should not be tolerated, irrelevant of what teams are playing or their long-standing rivalries. All football fans should feel safe when making their way to a match, and this was completely disregarded by these individuals on this occasion." A 50 pence coin is being sold for £36,000 in Great Yarmouth. The Brexit-themed coin was minted in 2020 to mark the UK's departure from the European Union on January the 31st, 2020. It's been designed with the words "peace, prosperity and friendship with all nations" on one side, while an image of Queen Elizabeth II adorns the other. These coins are not generally considered rare, as around 10 million have been released. But many collectors are still eager to get hold of one because of their historical significance. This local seller is asking for £36,000 or the best offer. Dozens more have been listed on eBay for up to £60,000. Last month, a Kew Gardens 50 pence piece went up for sale in Dereham for just £185. It was considered the UK's rarest coin, but this title was recently stolen by a 50 pence piece depicting the Atlantic salmon with the king's portrait. So if you've got the odd 36,000 knocking about, well, you know what to buy your nearest and dearest for Christmas.
Oh, more news shortly. First, though, an offer from Vision Norfolk. Mark Smith has asked us to let you know that they've been given a few complimentary tickets to see the Christmas Spectacular Water Circus at the Great Yarmouth Hippodrome. The tickets are for the 2:30 performance on Friday the 3rd of January. The tickets are being offered on a first-come, first-served basis, and you will need to make your own transport arrangements. If you are interested, please contact Mark on 01603 573000 extension 34 or mark.smith@visionnorfolk.org.uk. If you would like a ticket, they will try to offer the tickets in pairs to accommodate a sighted companion. Okay, time to bring a Christmas flavour to the proceedings. Here's Julie with a true tale, definitely in the Christmas spirit.
Hello everyone. Oh my goodness, where has this year gone? Doesn't seem 5 minutes since we were chatting last Christmas. Lots has happened my end. Indeed, I've left my home in the country and am now living opposite Dusty in Gorston, so swapping fields for beach. And I'm very happy here, it has to be said. I thought I'd share a little story with you today. Now, my friend Paul used to look after the events at Fairhaven Gardens. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a beautiful place situated in a little village called South Walsham, not far from Acle. The long, winding, earth-floored walks takes you through woodland, flanked by all sorts of bracken and natural shrubs with amazing aromas and textures. These trails all skirt around the end of South Walsham Broad, which is a haven for wildlife. Geese, ducks, moorhens, coots, swans can be heard in a cacophony of sounds, plus oars splashing rhythmically in and out of the water as dinghies are rowed ashore, or the flapping of sails as yachts tack. Then, of course, there's the chug of small boat engines, accompanied either by the smell of a two-stroke outboard, a petrol engine, or a diesel, as the owners spend their leisure time, To quote Ratty from that beautiful book Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham, simply messing about in boats. Their voices carrying clearly across the water. There's a coffee shop near the entrance with very indulgent cakes and savouries, all very naughty stuff, and lots of picnic areas dotted about, giving the opportunity to enjoy your own food in comfort and room for the kiddies to run about and play. It's definitely worth a visit throughout any of the seasons. However, something different happens at this time of year. A very special visitor makes an appearance, and that's what I'm going to tell you about today. About a couple of years ago, Paul rang me and asked if I would help out, explaining that the very special visitor needed extra help as his elves were working their little striped socks off back at the North Pole in readiness for Christmas Eve. But because he had promised to make a visit to Fairhaven, he wouldn't let us down. Well, by now you've obviously guessed that our special visitor was Father Christmas. So I readily agreed to help out. I wasn't going to miss out an opportunity like that, now was I? Now, the plan was that the copious children, accompanied by adults, eager to visit him, first needed to find the grotto hidden in the woods. Not only that, on their way, panto characters, played by other friends, would pop out from behind trees and speak to the children. All very exciting for everyone. It was a very cold day. Adults were muffled in great big cosy coats, boots and gloves, but most of the children were dressed up in bright colours as fairies, elves, princes or princesses. They were so excited that they just didn't feel the cold. Deep in the heart of the woodland, Father Christmas grotto was toasty warm. Decorated inside with very aromatic foliage like holly, ivy, conifer and, of course, mistletoe. A glowing warm fire in the corner with a pot of cinnamon tea filled the air with amazing festive cheer. He sat on a huge wooden throne-style chair, clad in a bright red tunic and hat, both trimmed with white fluffy fur. A wide black belt fastened with a shiny brass buckle around his extremely large tummy. Mrs. Claus had obviously been feeding him up for his epic world trip in a few days' time. He wore big black heavy boots to conquer all weathers. Little round glasses surrounded his incredibly kind eyes, and the whole look was topped off with a snowy white, soft, flowing beard. His deep voice greeted each child with a hearty ho, 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 and everything was absolutely idyllic. Now, all was going really well. Father Christmas had loads of lists requesting particular toys which the children so desperately wished for, and of course he told them all he would do his very best to bring their preferred gifts, although if they were very expensive or his elves found them very difficult to make or deliver, he couldn't promise, and everyone understood that and they were happy. Now, whilst all this was happening inside, I was outside the grotto dressed in a swashbuckling pirate's outfit with a huge black brimmed felt hat, green-ribbed corduroy-type velvety feel tunic and trousers, and long brown leather boots. My job was to ensure each child, just one at a time, was accompanied by an adult before they entered. Father Christmas was very particular about having very personal conversations with everyone. Then I noticed a little boy standing all alone by the fence, with a smooth-haired black Labrador, and he was looking very sad. He had attempted to join the queue, and his parents had left him there whilst they took his little sister to see Father Christmas. So I asked, Why are you alone? Wouldn't you like to go and see Father Christmas? Oh, I would, he replied longingly, but you see, it's Jasper, my dog. There's no way I can take him in there in case he upsets Rudolph. His little face was so serious and voice so intense. So I explained to him that it would be okay to take Jasper in. Father Christmas loves dogs, I said, and although it was very kind of him to worry about Rudolph, he wasn't here today. Father Christmas has given him and all the other reindeers a day off. And he looked at me with wide eyes and he said, "That's kind of him, isn't it? I expect they are sleeping. They've got a long way to fly on Christmas Eve, haven't they?" "Indeed they have," I replied. And putting my hand on his shoulder, I gently guided this caring little person and Jasper to his parents so that he too could pay a visit to Father Christmas. And you know what? I bet he asks for a present for Jasper too. What do you think?
James Paget Hospital Choir and Away in a Manger. Well, Andrew is a regular voice on Grapevine and is away at the moment visiting his son and family in New Zealand. Before leaving, he recorded the following to give us a flavour of Christmas in the Sun.
Hello everyone and Merry Christmas. Andrew here. Today I'd like to tell you about what my Christmas will be like this year. As by the time you're listening to this, I'll be many miles away having a very different Yuletide in New Zealand, where one half of our family now reside. Our daughter and her now husband moved to the land of the long white cloud 11 years ago, and with the addition of two children, are enjoying life there. We've been fortunate to visit on several occasions, usually at this time of year, because as you may have realised, it's moving into summer in the Southern Hemisphere. So that, of course, puts a very different complexion on Christmas. It took us a while to get adjusted to it and enjoy their festive season. But once we realised this is Christmas and not just a summer party, we've learned to enjoy it very much. Of course, one of the major differences is the weather and the fact that it's light till 10 o'clock in the evening. So there's not very many houses or streets lit up with festive decorations. The Christmas period is a main holiday time in New Zealand and the equivalent of the school summer holidays too. Most businesses close for a fortnight and some, my daughter's local butcher for instance, close for a month and take their holidays. Now the majority of Kiwis don't have a passport as any foreign trip as you can imagine is pretty well a long haul. And while some go across to Australia, many tend to head off to the numerous beautiful scenic parts of both the North and South Island of New Zealand. Life's very much geared to the outdoors there, so camper vans and campsites are all very well equipped and plentiful. So naturally, this all makes for a very different Yuletide. For example, Christmas Day, a lot of people in the area where Kate lives go to the beach on Christmas morning with snacks, and possibly a bottle of something fizzy, and enjoy a swim, the sun and the atmosphere there, as there's many people enjoying the beach, before going back home for the main part of the day. Now, Christmas dinner, and you'll be hard-pushed to find a turkey in New Zealand. So one of the favoured dishes is a ham. And this is usually big enough to last a fortnight. It's kept in a cool place in a muslin bag, which is known as a ham bag. This is served warm, or often pre-cooked and served cold, garnished with pineapple rings. And this is the staple of a New Zealand Christmas table. Though many younger people, my son-in-law included, I'm pleased to say, are a bit of a whiz on the barbecue. So a nice beef rib or maybe a lamb steak are never far away. Our family still make a proper Christmas pud out there though at the start of November. But the generic Christmas dessert is the pav. That's a pavlova served with cream and fruit. And where our supermarkets are stacked high with packets of mince pies, over in New Zealand they're packed with pavlova cases. Feasting over, Boxing Day is a normal sort of day in New Zealand, unlike ours, and a lot of leisure facilities are open, and being the summer, several big sporting events are often in progress. As we know here, television plays a big part in Christmas, but it's very different in New Zealand. There are very few terrestrial channels. So with a population of only just over 5 million people between the two islands, there isn't a great amount of high quality programmes. So there's not too much slobbing out in front of the TV, but you wouldn't want to when the weather is so good. The days between Christmas and New Year are very relaxed, which is typical in New Zealand. New Year's Eve is, though, as all around the world, well celebrated. And New Zealanders do glory in being one of the first countries in the world to welcome the New Year in. Our family live near a major city, so there's usually an excellent firework display to enjoy. But not too many people have their own because being in the middle of summer, there is always a fire risk to consider. Yeah, a very different Christmas. But of course, children are children. They still get the same thrill of opening presents on Christmas morning. But a big difference we have found in NZ is that certainly on the South Island where our family are, it's not as consumer orientated as the UK. The kids aren't bombarded with adverts on TV. And there isn't such a clamour to have the latest this and that. Probably because due to New Zealand's location and size of population, there isn't a massive demand driving consumerism along, which I'm sure actually many of us would appreciate. There's a phrase in New Zealand which goes, New Zealand, 13 hours ahead, 30 years behind. And it's kind of true, but in a nice way. It's a very relaxed, I call it a kind country, and not just at Christmas. And it deserves its reputation for fairness and respect, be that in world affairs, domestic government, business and even sport. So, may I wish you all Merry Kirihimate, me te Happy Nuala, which hopefully in Maori is Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer, those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Dust off the sun and moon and sing a song of cheer. Just fill your basket full of sandwiches and wieners. Then lock the house up, now you're set. And on the beach you'll see the girls in their bikinis, as cute as ever, but they never get them wet. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer, those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. You'll wish that summer could always be. Soda and pretzels and beer.
the sun and moon and sing a song of cheer. Don't have to tell a girl and fella about a driving or some romantic movie scene. Why, from the moment that those lovers start arriving, you'll see more kissing in the car than on the screen. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. You'll wish that summer could always be here. You'll wish that summer could always be here. You'll wish that summer could always be here.
Well, not a Christmas song, but appropriate to where Andrew is at the moment. He will be back on newsreading duty at the beginning of February. If you feel robbed of cold and snow, as if, Alison, who's sitting in Andrew's news chair whilst he's away, gives us details of a trip to Germany.
Frohe Weihnachten, or Merry Christmas, as German people would say it. However, people don't start to greet each other in this way until the 24th of December. Prior to that date, they may wish each other Frohe Adventszeit, or a happy Advent season. In this edition of Grapevine, we thought it would be good to look further afield and find out how Christmas is celebrated in other countries, and I chose to look at Germany. Just like in any other Western European country, the run-up to Christmas is a busy time of shopping for presents, deciding who in the family will spend Christmas with whom, and preparing food. There are, however, some traditions that are specific to German-speaking countries, mainly Germany, Austria and Switzerland. Advent Sunday, in Germany as in the UK, is the first of four Sundays preceding Christmas Day, when many families start an Advent wreath. This is an evergreen wreath containing four candles, one to be lit on each of the four Sundays. The wreath was even more important in the past, when German families didn't decorate their Christmas tree until the 24th of December, so until that date, the wreath was the only pre-Christmas decoration in the house. Another Advent decoration is the Schwibbogen, or candle arch, also popular in many UK homes. The origin of this is related to the mining traditions of the Erzgebirge mountain region in central Germany. It may have first developed as a painted metal candle holder for the miners' Christmas work shift, the last shift of the year. The smith responsible for making mining tools throughout the year crafted the candle holder, decorating it with symbols commonly associated with the lives of the miners. The arch symbolises the mine tunnel entrance. The candles represent the torches used to illuminate the mine interior. Rather than metal, most candle arches today are made of wood. From the end of November, Christmas markets are a popular feature of many German towns and cities. These markets date back to the Middle Ages, when a special two-day early winter market would enable people to stock up on provisions for the forthcoming cold winter. Gradually, these became specialised Christmas markets, the earliest of which dates back to 1434 in Dresden, eastern Germany. Nowadays, almost every German-speaking town has a Christmas market, and the tradition has spread across Europe and North America. Glühwein, gingerbread, Stollen are popular among visitors, and the stalls offer a vast choice of wooden, glass and ceramic Christmas decorations and gifts. The atmosphere is vibrant and festive. In early December, some German communities celebrate two saints' days. St. Barbara on the 4th of December commemorates the legend of Barbara, who lived allegedly in what is now Turkey and who was locked up in a tower by her father whenever he went away to keep her safe. It is said that Barbara became a Christian during one of his absences, for which he commanded she be beheaded. Barbara found a dried up cherry tree branch in her cell. She kept this moist with drops of her drinking water, and on the day of her execution, cherry blossoms appeared. The 6th of December is St. Nicholas Day. Nicholas was a bishop in Turkey during the 3rd century who helped the poor and the sick. Over the centuries, his story has evolved. He became known as Sinterklaas in Holland, Santa Claus in the USA, and Father Christmas in the UK. In Catholic German-speaking areas, he is said to bring small gifts which are left in shoes by the door for children on the 6th of December. The main Christmas celebration in Germany takes place on the 24th of December. Even today, many families still don't allow their children to see the Christmas tree until this particular day. Presents are exchanged in the evening. The presents are believed to come not from Father Christmas, but from the Christkindl, an angelic-like Christ child, or from the more secular Weihnachtsmann, a Father Christmas-type figure, depending on whether families are religious or not. The Christmas meal is usually eaten on the evening of the 24th. A very popular menu is Kartoffelsalat mit Würstchen, which is potato salad and sausages, and often sauerkraut. Catholic families often have fish for the main course, and many families eat roast goose or duck. There is no Christmas pudding or Christmas cake in Germany. A gatto is more likely to be offered as dessert. The 25th of December, known as the Erster Weihnachtstag, or first day of Christmas, is a time for celebrating with family and friends, as is the 26th, which is not called Boxing Day, but just the second day of Christmas. The Christmas season officially ends on the 6th of January, on the Feast of the Three Kings, or Epiphany. Nowadays in Germany, the day is often known for a fundraising event by the so-called Star Singers. This event is organised by the Catholic Church, and groups of young people, often dressed in costumes like the Three Kings, sing in their local area to raise money for charity. The leader of each group carries a star. In Catholic regions, house blessing ceremonies may take place. The three letters C, M and B for the three kings, Caspar, Melchior and Balthazar, but which also mean in Latin, Christ bless this house, are written in chalk above the door. A very happy Christmas to all our listeners.
Silent Night, composed by Franz Gruber, and the original German words from the Dresden Singers. Right, much more news awaits, so over to our latest double act, Dusty and Margaret, for the second part of this week's local stories.
A rumbling row between council leaders and the Yarmouth MP over its housing plan have been stirred up again after he was accused of acting extremely cynically or willfully ignorant. Carl Smith, leader of Great Yarmouth Council and head of the Conservative group, together with Labour leader Trevor Wainwright, has criticised Yarmouth Reform MP Rupert Lowe's continued opposition to its local plan. The policy sets out where development can take place in the borough over the next few years in order to meet housing needs, with the latest update detailing where 4,350 houses can be built. The council is legally obligated to have one, and its final draft is currently open for consultation. However, the former Southampton Football Club boss continues to make critical posts on social media and has called on the council to urgently rethink their support for these outrageous housing plans before being forced on into our area. Mr. Lowe has recently offered to meet with councillors to discuss the policy in his post online. However, an invitation from Great Yarmouth Borough Council sent in October has been ignored. Responding to his comments, the two council leaders said, "It appears this is a simple rhetoric designed to make your fanciful assertions appear more credible." They go on to say that scrapping the local plan would be ruinous for the borough, and they have questioned whether Mr. Lowe is acting extremely cynically or being willfully ignorant to not recognise publicly the risks of not having the policy in place. He has also not offered any alternative proposals to address Yarmouth's housing needs. Mr. Lowe says that he has replied privately to the letter, adding, "I'm not playing these out over Facebook." He said, "The Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government has said housing targets can be challenged and that he is willing to work with people to implement sensible local plan. The number of houses the council is suggesting is unsustainable and needs services like roads and schools and dentists first. We should not roll over and accept these targets."
The future of the area's libraries could be at risk if Norfolk County Council does not receive sufficient money to provide services, the leader of the authority has warned. With £45 million of cuts and savings needed to balance the books next year, Kay Mason Billig, Conservative leader at County Hall, said she was not able to promise libraries would be spared. Her comments came after Liberal Democrat County Councillor Saul Penfold asked for reassurances about the future of libraries and other services the council does not have a legal duty to provide. Mrs. Mason Billig said, "We've always prided ourselves on our library service. We have one of the best in the country. This council will always want to keep all of our libraries open. However, the Labour government are unlikely to give us the sort of money we are likely to need in order to run all the services that we want to run. Councils are likely to learn how much funding they will receive from central government to provide services later this week." County Hall leaders have already warned the £45 million it said it would need to save could have to be increased because of Chancellor Rachel Reeves' budget announcements. Mrs. Mason Billig said, "When it comes to our budget, we will have to wait and see what the settlement is, and we'll have to cut our cloth accordingly. But if I can protect those services, I absolutely will." Norfolk currently has 47 libraries, and County Hall has largely resisted closing them so far, despite the need to make cuts and savings, unlike many other councils around the country. The council did propose the closure of a number of libraries in 2003, but only two ended up shutting, and that was Bradwell and Lazar House in Norwich. At the same meeting, Mrs. Mason Billig revealed she was one of nearly 3 million people who signed a petition calling for another general election. She said, "I've never known such an unpopular government in such a short space of time." Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer has ruled out calling an early general election in response to the petition, although a general debate will be held in Westminster Hall in Parliament in the new year.
An interactive map has revealed which parts of Norfolk are projected to be in danger of coastal flooding by 2050. The map was created by Climate Central, an independent group that researches and reports on the impacts of climate change using science, technology and big data. It indicates part of the Norfolk Broads, North Norfolk and West Norfolk, are likely to be at further risk. Climate Central has cautioned that the map should be seen as a screening tool, noting that large data sets always include some error. The organisation advises that the map is a starting point for identifying areas requiring more detailed investigation. It comes as a report released by the Environment Agency found that 6.3 million properties, about one in five homes and businesses in England, are in areas at risk of river, sea and flash flooding. The figures are up from 5.5 million in 2018, as the update draws on much more advanced data and modelling, including new mapping down to a 2M scale, as well as factoring in recent changes which have taken place, such as new building and a worsening climate. The analysis accounts for the impacts of climate change for the first time and warns it will lead to an increase in the number of properties in areas at risk from rivers and sea or surface water to about 8 million by the middle of the century, or around one in four homes and businesses. Julie Foley, Director of Flood Risk Strategy at the Environment Agency, said, "We have spent the last few years transforming our understanding of flood and coastal erosion risk in England, drawing on the best available data from the Environment Agency and local authorities, as well as improved modelling and technological advances. Providing the nation with the best available information on flood and coastal erosion risk is vital to ensuring that policy makers, practitioners and communities are ready to adapt to flooding and coastal change." The report also highlighted North Norfolk as one of the country's hotspots for coastal erosion. The assessment on coastal erosion, the first to be published since 2017, warns that 3,500 properties are in areas at risk of being lost to the sea up to 2055, a figure which rises to 32,800 if shoreline management plans for threatened areas are not delivered.
Discussions have started over a major shake-up that would see Norfolk's councils abolished and new ones created. After the government announced it wanted to see councils redrawn, council leaders met on Tuesday, December the 17th, to begin the process of thrashing out the proposals to submit to the government. With the prospect of councils being scrapped to be replaced by one or two larger unitary councils with an elected mayor for Norfolk and Suffolk, some have raised concerns that local accountability would be lost. The expectation that areas will have to give a clear commitment to devolution and reorganisation by mid-January if they want to postpone next year's county elections has also raised eyebrows. Sam Chapman-Allen, leader of Breckland Council, said he was supportive of a Norfolk and Suffolk mayor, but felt the proposals could have been more ambitious. On local government reorganisation, he said, "There needs to be a bottom-up approach to ensure we put residents at the heart of it. People need to be able to recognise their local councillor and their town halls. They need to feel connected to things like planning and where new homes and schools are put." Sue Holland, Liberal Democrat lead of Broadland District Council, said, "There is always an opportunity to improve the way we do things, but we need to be very careful about how we approach local government reorganisation. The last thing we need is for government to impose something based on a one-size-fits-all model." Tim Adams, Lib Dem leader of North Norfolk District Council, said he was worried about the focus on services such as social care and children's services could see services like tourism squeezed out. The government wants consensus, but it remains to be seen how that will play out in a county where previous shake-up attempts caused acrimony. Mike Stonard, Labour leader of Norwich City Council, awarded unitary status in 2010, only for the coalition government to scrap it, said, "My role in this is uncomplicated and I will be unflinching in my pursuit of what is needed, getting the best possible deal for Norwich. I will work with central government and colleagues across our neighbouring councils to develop and agree the best solution for Norwich and the wider region. But there is one thing not negotiable from the city's perspective, and that is getting the best deal for our residents." Alistair Beals, independent leader of West Norfolk Council, said, "Our top priority will always be to seek an advocate for the best outcome for the communities we serve in West Norfolk, ensuring local government is the right shape and size to deliver efficient, accountable services."
Forget therapy dogs. The James Paget has a new kind of comfort companion, a friendly cat that's stealing hearts and earning its own fan page on Facebook and exasperating health bosses. For the past 2 months, the whiskered wonder named Bobby has been visiting the James Paget University Hospital in Galston and bringing comfort to patients and staff. The cat has become an unlikely star and even inspired its own social media following after employers set up a Facebook page called James Paget Hospital Cat of Love. But hospital bosses are not feline fine about the visitor. A spokesperson for the James Paget said, "We are asking our staff and visitors not to encourage the cat. While it is popular with some, there will be patients and visitors who may not want to have a cat in the waiting areas, for example, if they have allergies." They also said the site itself is not particularly safe for a cat, especially as some construction work is due to begin in the main reception. Jenny Naley, 42, is one of the members of staff who finds solace in Bobby's visits. She said, "If I have a really bad day at work, I always try to pop to the front of the hospital to get a quick cuddle from her. She does really lift you up, and many of the staff too." On the Facebook page, which now has more than 400 followers, staff and patients can share their photos of the cat. One woman said, "This cat must be an angel watching over those who need support. I never see this cat eating. Her role seems totally to spread love and hope." It is believed that Bobby lives in a house opposite the hospital across the main A47 Lowestoft Road.
A mother has expressed delight that a life-saving machine, which she raised £50,000 to buy for a hospital following the death of her son, is finally going to be used. The £50,000 Horus mole mapping machine was donated to the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital by Wendy Evans in June 2023 following fundraising efforts. Mrs. Evans donated the machine following the death of her son Neil, aged 48, and from Galston in June 2021 after he had been diagnosed with melanoma, a type of skin cancer. He died in Sydney, Australia, where he had lived since 2004. For 15 months, the Horus device had sat idle in its box at the hospital, and the family had raised questions as to why it wasn't in use. But now the machine has been put into the skin cancer ward of the hospital and will be used by patients for the first time on Wednesday, December the 18th. "I'm delighted that the machine has been accepted by the hospital. I hope it can save lives in the future, and it's an incredibly proud moment," Mrs. Evans said. "It's just unbelievable how successful the fundraising was, which all started with a small tea, coffee and cake afternoon in my garden, which raised £500. From there, with help of so many people, it just grew and grew. Dermatologist Dr. Jennifer Garlock said the hospital may not have seen it as urgent as the rest of us, but added she was so pleased that the machine will finally be put to use. Mrs. Evans of Galston added she was proud that her son's legacy will live on in Norfolk through the machine to help save lives locally, as her son's death had done in Australia. His former partner Sonia launched the Neil Evans Melanoma Foundation, an Australian registered charity dedicated to raising funds to support melanoma patients. The Australian charity helps patients access treatments and clinical trials and assists with transport, accommodation and other costs during their treatment journeys. Colin Glover from Melanoma UK said that Mrs. Evans was an inspiration and that the family should be immensely proud of her commitment and dedication to see her mission to have the machine put into the hospital. Neil Evans was a sports enthusiast in his youth, playing football, tennis, cricket and golf. And when he was 15, he was the first person from Norfolk selected to play badminton for the England junior team. He competed at under 15 and under 16 levels, travelling all over the country and to Ireland and the Netherlands, winning the under 16 All England Boys doubles title. Unfortunately, a serious ankle injury when he was 17 cut short his badminton career. Neil had attended Cliff Park Junior and High Schools and before going to university at Loughborough, where he would study banking and finance. He took a year off and travelled to Australia. He never forgot the place and in 2004 emigrated there, where he worked in banks, becoming Division Director of Macquarie. In 2017, he was diagnosed with melanoma. And Mr. Evans was an Ipswich Town Football Club season ticket holder.
The family of a man who died in a car crash on the A47 is raising money for his funeral. Thomas Hurran, 36, was driving a white Range Rover Evoque when it collided with a blue Vauxhall Astra on the southbound carriageway between Hopton and Galston at 8:40 p.m. on Wednesday, December the 11th. In 2004, his brother James, who was 22 at the time, died in the horrific Boxing Day tsunami whilst on holiday in Thailand. The fundraiser is asking for donations to give Tom the best send-off possible. So far, the campaign has raised £1,480 of a target of £2,500. To donate, go to the Thomas James Hurran Appeal on GoFundMe. On Monday, December the 16th, Thomas's parents Dale and Debbie said this: "At just 36 years old, Thomas was a much-loved son, brother and friend, remembered for his zest for life, his passion for boxing, running and the gym. Thomas leaves behind his heartbroken family, his mum Debbie, dad Dale and brother Daniel, who will forever cherish the special memories that they shared together. Thomas has now been reunited in heaven with his beloved brother James, and together they will forever watch over their family and friends with love. Our hearts are completely broken by such a tragic loss, but Thomas's love, spirit, and happy nature will remain in our hearts forever. The family kindly requests that their privacy is respected during this difficult time," they said. In the wake of the tragic crash, hundreds of people have been paying tribute to Thomas, describing him as a genuine and lovely man. The driver of the Vauxhall, a man in his 20s, was arrested on suspicion of causing death by dangerous driving and drug driving also.
The driver arrested after a man died in a crash on the A47 has been released on bail. The collision took place between Galston and Hopton on the night of December the 11th and resulted in the death of 36-year-old Thomas Hurran. Mr. Harron was driving a white Range Rover Evoque, while the other vehicle involved was a blue Vauxhall Astra. The driver of the Vauxhall, a man aged in his 20s, was arrested on suspicion of causing death by dangerous driving and drug driving. Norfolk police said the man has since been released on bail until March the 5th next year. Plans to change the speed limit along a dangerous stretch of the A143 to 50 miles per hour have moved forward. Norfolk County Council is currently seeking a traffic revision order for the section of Beccles Road from Belton to Fritton, with one councillor pushing for the change. It is hoped the reduction will be in place by late 2025, provided the legal process and the draft regulation order is cleared. Calls from the public to change the speed limit came following several crashes on the stretch of road. Councillor Carl Annison said, "People voiced their concerns, so I'm seeing this through to completion. I have approved the draft regulation order for advertisement, marking this as yet another milestone of my commitment to the speed reduction on this section of road to 50 miles per hour." In May last year, a grey Vauxhall Mokka collided with a blue Mercedes C-Class, which was towing a trailer containing a Range Rover. A woman in her 70s, who was a passenger in the Vauxhall Mokka, died. Three others who were in the Mokka were taken to hospital with serious injuries. And in December, two people suffered injuries in a two-car collision on the road.
Well, news the third will be along eventually, but we still have a crowd of Grapevine people waiting to step up to the mic. Here's Margaret Two, as we call her, with some fascinating info on two familiar winter birds.
And now, as a complete change, I'd like to talk to you today about two birds which we associate with winter and which we associate with Christmas, starting with the little robin redbreast. Now, the robin is closely associated with Christmas, often appearing on cards sent during the festive season. Now, this appears to have arisen in an unusual way. Early postmen wore red uniforms and were nicknamed robins. Victorian artists then put robins on the cards themselves. The bird usually depicted carrying an envelope in its beak. The association with Christmas soon stuck. And the robin is, without question, Britain's best loved bird, regularly topping any opinion poll that's carried out to find the nation's favourite. And this is in no small part down to its habit of coming into our gardens and boldly hopping around our footsteps, our doorsteps, especially when temperatures drop and food becomes hard to find. And robins are known as the gardener's friend, but it might be more accurate to call the gardener the robin's friend, as the bird benefits from our hard work in turning over the soil, enabling it to sneak in and grab an earthworm or a beetle revealed by the spade. And it's long puzzled ornithologists that British robins are particularly prone to following humans, whereas continental European robins are much shyer and rarely approach people. The answer appears to lie in two factors. First, the British love of gardening, which provides countless opportunities for human-bird interactions. And second, the scarcity of large mammals such as wild boars in Britain, which the robin would have followed around as they turned over the soil in woods and forests instead. Oddly enough, though, some people do not want robins too close. If a robin comes into the house itself, this is traditionally regarded as a very bad thing, supposedly resulting in the death of one of the household occupants. Yet, strangely, other people hold a contradictory opinion and regard the appearance of a robin indoors as a positive omen. And so the other bird that I'd like to just talk about is the starling, because the starling is not usually a contender for Britain's favourite bird. Often denounced as a bird table bully, its gawky appearance and tuneless whistling does not make it endearing. However, while from a distance starlings appear rather drab, their plumage is actually a striking combination of dark, glossy feathers and tiny, pale spots. Quite beautiful, really. Starlings are one of our commonest breeding birds. In autumn and winter, the British population is joined by millions of starlings from further north and east, mainly from Arctic Russia, where conditions are too cold for the birds to find food and to survive during the bitter Siberian winter. And actually in Yarmouth, we know all about flocks of starlings, don't we? During the day, they feed in a wide range of habitats, including grassy fields, muddy estuaries, and of course our gardens. But as dusk falls, they leave these areas and join together in flocks, heading purposefully towards their roost sites. Now, these may be in towns and cities where the warmth of buildings increases the birds' chances of survival, or in areas of woodland where they can spend the night in twigs and branches of bare trees. But the biggest and most famous roost of all is among the reed beds on the Somerset Levels. Of course, here in Norfolk, we know all about reed beds, don't we? Former peat diggings transformed by conservationists into a vast nature reserve. And the other thing which I didn't know about starlings is that while they are silent while they're on the wing in these large flocks, you can hear the rustling of their feathers, and that's why a flock of starlings is known as a murmuration. And I didn't know that at all, but it's interesting, isn't it? And just lastly, very quickly, many years ago, when my father was serving on the lightships in Trinity House, there was one occasion when an enormous flock of starlings settled actually on the lantern and blocked out the light. I suppose they were attracted by the warmth from the lantern. But anyway, that's another story.
Early each day to the steps of St. Paul, old bird woman comes in her own special way to the people she calls. Come buy my bags full of crumbs, come feed the little bird, show them you care, and you'll be glad. So bare, all it takes is tuppence from you. Feed the birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence, tuppence a bag. Feed the birds. That's what she cries, while overhead her birds fill the skies. All around the cathedral, the saints and apostles look down as she sells her wares. Although you can't see it, you know they are smiling each time.
Tuppence a bag.
listen, listen, she's calling to you. Feed the birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence, tuppence a
Always on at Christmas somewhere, Mary Poppins, starring Julie Andrews, and Feed the Birds. Mind you, with inflation, that tuppence is no more likely 4 quid plus VAT or something. Well, Margaret will be back with more news in just a while. First, though, she looks back at what was happening in the news in December 1957.
Now, forget all the news I've been reading today. I'm now going to meander through the Great Yarmouth Mercury and the headlines that caught my eye in December 1957. Gosh, a long while ago. The first headline was Official Opening of Great Yarmouth Girls High School. There was a picture of Mrs. K.M. Adlington, the mayor, who was chairman of the Board of Governors, and Miss L. Cartwright, mistress of Girton College, who performed the opening ceremony. Mrs. Adlington was wearing a stunning hat, and all the ladies in the pictures also wore hats. And an event that I suspect wouldn't have been conducted in a ladylike way was Free Christmas Show. Mr. F.A. Wright, manager of the Regal Cinema, announced this week there would be a free film show at the cinema on the morning of December the 21st for any child between 5 and 15, and the mayor, Mrs. Adlington, would also be present. Now, who can remember going to the ABC Miners in their youth? I certainly do. Yes, I own up to it. And Mrs. Adlington was in the news again. She was a busy lady. She visited Northgate Hospital, where she met the oldest resident, Mrs. Emma Applegate, aged 94. Patients had their Christmas dinner of turkey carved on the ward by doctors, and the Christmas fare included 19 large cakes, 80 puddings and hundreds of mince pies from the hospital kitchens. And entertainment now. At the Regent Cinema was Alec Guinness in Barnacle Bill, Rio Grande with John Wayne, and An Affair to Remember, starring Cary Grant. The Great Yarmouth Amateur Operatic and Dramatic Society was staging Cinderella as their pantomime. 12 magnificent scenes with a cast of 60, including Marilyn Phillips, Diana Stonell, Linda Taylor, Jim Aldous, Jack Bacon, Frank Footer, with the Phyllis Adams Juveniles. And the seats were 6 shillings to 2 and 6 pence. Now, the Victoria Hotel was offering Christmas Day luncheon for 15 shillings per head. And you could welcome in the new year with an old-time carnival ball at the Floral Hall. Oh yes, the haunt of my youth. Tickets 3 and 6 pence, while the Star Hotel had a 7-course dinner the same night. Tickets were 15 shillings. Now, how could you spend your money in 1957? I was only getting pocket money then, so I didn't have a lot of money. I wasn't working. Still at school. Arthur Hollis in the marketplace had New Zealand butter at 2 and 7 pence a pound, and David Greggs in King Street, where they had black and white tiles on the floor covered in sawdust. They had Christmas cakes from 14 shillings and sausage meat 2 and 6 pence a pound. And to help you get into the Christmas spirit, divers were selling ginger wine at 7 and 6 pence a bottle, ruby port 16 and 9 pence, Solera sherry 17 and 6 pence, 3-star rum 38 shillings, and a 3-star brandy at 36 shillings. Now, if you had a driver's licence in 1957, you could drive around the town in an Austin A70 for £465, a 1955 Ford Prefect, red leather upholstery and a heater for £530. Or perhaps this would have been on your list to Father Christmas that year, Hannant's the toy shop had a popular car for 3 to 6 year olds, a Triang T-stroke 40B in brilliant two-tone finish with headlights and hooter for £5.19 and sixpence. And what were you listening to in December 1957? It was, quite unseasonably, Elvis Presley singing Jailhouse Rock. Oh, my lost youth!
Definitely a lack of Christmas songs that year. That was the Yuletide number one. Well, to give Margaret a chance to don her newsreading hat, here's a piece from Andy, going back to the days of yore. Yore what? I'm not sure.
And now, a Christmas story. It's entitled I'm Dreaming of a Medieval Christmas, and it's by Tom Hodkinson. And it concerns what went on in medieval times and how that's related to us. The medieval culture as a whole was less work-oriented, and the whole point of Christmas was to follow the injunction in Ecclesiastes to eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. And work was cancelled for a full 12 days or more, from the 25th of December until Plough Monday. We developed the Christmas tradition also because we needed cheering up in the depths of winter. To take 12 days off for drinking, watching plays and general partying was a way of coping with the hardships of the season. So it is this year too, when times are hard, money is tight and we're constantly told there's lots of gloom ahead by newspapers, there's more reason to eat, drink and be merry. The work-loving Protestants and Puritans of the 17th century, though, hated feasts, fasts and old-fashioned festivals like Christmas, which they saw as superstitious, popish, heathen. The feasts got in the way of productive activity. Indeed, one of the new freedoms that the Protestants insisted upon was the right to work over the Christmas holiday. The feasting culture, they felt, also led to drunkenness, debauchery, riots and casual sex. And if there's anything got a Puritan really riled, it was the sight of people enjoying themselves. In 1643, a London newspaper complained that Christmas commemorated an idol of the mass, and also that it was frequently abused to carnal liberty. Therefore, MPs cracked down on it. I think this sort of thing approach to things persists today. Parliament, by its very nature, is against fun and frivolity and would prefer an orderly, hard-working populace. There are very few exceptions. MPs are not the feasting type. They're Malvolios rather than Toby Belches. Well, during the Commonwealth, that brief triumph of grey parliamentarianism, Christmas was more or less banned. In 1643, an alliance between the Parliament and Scottish Government called the Solemn League and Covenant was signed, which led to a Christmas crackdown. London shopkeepers began to keep their shops open on Christmas Day. On Christmas Day of 1643, the miserable, bah humbug parliamentarians went into work as usual. The following year saw a set of reforms that effectively put an end to old-style communal feasting and dancing. In the 1650s, laws were introduced that made it compulsory for shops and markets to open on Christmas Day, and you could be fined if you were caught celebrating Christmas. With the restoration of Charles II in 1660, the reforms were abolished, and Christmas once again was celebrated openly. In essence, to get the spirit of Christmas right, we need to go back to 1450 or before. For a very modest outlay, we could literally celebrate like kings. It's possible to live very well on small amounts of money. You just have to go back in time. The necessary elements are huge quantities of booze, preferably spiced wine or punch from a communal punch bowl, large quantities of people, a complete suspension of work for at least 12 days, and that means switching off all the mobile phones, large numbers of candles, and lots of dancing and singing. As far as food goes, how about that exotic fruit, the orange? Swans were a common feature of the medieval banquet, as were venison, goose and woodcock. If you have the funds, then hire a musician. But better still, gather round the piano, bring the ukulele or ask the guitar-playing teenager to learn some Christmas ditties so everyone can have a sing-song. Fill the house with holly, ivory, rosemary and bays. Play cards, play board games, pass round the wassail bowl, be generous. As the early Tudor husbandry expert Thomas Tusser puts it, at Christmas we banquet, the rich with the poor. Who then but the miser openeth the door? Open your doors, be merry, dance, drink too much, fall over. It's the true spirit of Christmas, apparently.
Right, back to 2004, as Margaret brings you the rest of the week's local news, followed by more seasonal offerings.
An habitual drug user stole more than £3,000 in coins he raided from arcade machines during a spate of offences in the town, a court has heard. Craig Bulstridge, 47, who has been addicted to Class A drugs for the past 3 decades, struck at the arcades in Great Yarmouth. He damaged cash boxes and amassed a total of about £3,100 in £1 and £2 coins over a series of raids in the spring and summer. Norwich Crown Court heard Bulstridge had been at Wellington Pier in Great Yarmouth on April the 7th, when he took the cash box from an arcade machine containing £1 and £2 coins to the value of between £700 and £800. Simon Gladwell, prosecuting, said in May, Bulstridge was next at the Leisureland Arcade, where he emptied £800 in coins into a rucksack and fled after breaking into cash boxes. Then, on June the 2nd this year, he took about £500 in cash after damaging cash boxes at the Mint Arcade. Bulstridge then broke into about 6 machines in arcades on the Britannia Pier, when he stole £1,000 during the early hours of the morning. He appeared at court on Tuesday, December the 17th, after admitting to three thefts and criminal damage. Bulstridge also admitted fraud after trying to use a bank card stolen from a car in Yarmouth on April the 12th this year, and the theft of a bike worth £900 from Norwich Camping and Leisure on May the 13th. The defendant of Paget Road, Yarmouth, asked for 14 other offences, including eight thefts from gaming machines, to be taken into consideration. Imposing a custodial sentence of 38 weeks and 4 days imprisonment, recorder Nicola Fitchers said Bulstridge had an appalling offending history. She said there had been some degree of planning to the series of offences he had committed. Danielle O'Donovan, mitigating, said, "These are the offences of a Class A drug user over a couple of months." She said Bulstridge was an habitual Class A drug user and an habitual offender in the throes of a Class A drug addiction he's had for more than 30 years. The barrister said he had been offending to fund a habit which he could not pay for legitimately. A family has opened what it believed to be the biggest soft play area at a local pub. Borough Hall, on Lord's Lane in Borough Castle, is well known for its outdoor swimming pool, wedding chapel and Sunday carvery. And now the Southey family, who own and run the establishment near Galston, have spent £80,000 on refurbishing its three-tier indoor playground. Among the new Fun Zone's attractions are a section for babies and toddlers, a sensory area, a zip line, and a mini arcade. The biggest addition is an artificial football pitch, measuring some 10 metres by 4 metres on the second tier. Paul Southey said, "It's looking amazing. The football court turned out really well. It's probably the biggest soft play area in a pub in the region. The parents can enjoy the pub and know their children are in a safe environment." The venue is run by Mr. Southey and his wife Pauline, with their son David Southey and his wife Hayley. The family, who run the nearby Kingfisher for 14 years, took over Borough Hall in January 2020, only 3 months before the country went into lockdown. Since taking over the pub, they have spent £300,000 revamping the plaza, toilets and function room. Mr. Southey said, "Our customers are really good. They've supported us well. Hopefully we're doing something right." The new play area costs £5 for the whole day. It will be available for children's birthday parties, and opening hours are Monday to Friday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m, Saturday 10 a.m. to 6 p.m, and closed on Sunday. Football is coming home for one local club as it returns to its original ground. Galston Football Club is set to move back to its historic roots at the Recreation Ground in a phased move following an agreement with Great Yarmouth Borough Council. Initially, youth teams will begin playing at the venue, with plans for infrastructure development to enable adult teams to join in the near future. The move comes 3 years after the club left their previous home of Emerald Park, with plans to relocate to a new £900,000 ground at East Norfolk Sixth Form College. However, those plans later fell through, with club bosses saying it was not a viable option. By July 2022, the club reached an agreement with Lowestoft Town to host home games at Crown Meadow for the 2022-23 season. For the following season, Galston secured a ground share with Great Yarmouth Town Football Club at the Wellesley Recreation Ground. A club spokesperson said, "This is a massive step forward for the football club in terms of identifying a sustainable home ground. Being able to return the adult section of the club to the venue where it all began is particularly special for all those that remember the site as the original home of the football club. What we will be able to achieve for all our players, and most importantly the local community, will be long-lasting and of huge benefit. Carl Smith, borough council leader, said, "This is a really positive outcome and means the club can hopefully look to build on a success with a solid future at Gorston Recreation Ground after being based outside of the town for many years." Gorston Football Club moved to the Recreation Ground in 1889 with the first match at the new ground, played on November the 9th that year, a 2-0 win over Yarmouth St Paul's. The record of attendance of 4,473 was set in 1951 for an FA first round replay against Orient. In 1982, the club left the Recreation Ground to move to Emerald Park. A man arrested after another man was stabbed on the street was found to have been conspiring to rob drug dealers in the county, a court has heard. Alan Hetherington, 36, was one of a group of people arrested shortly after a man was stabbed in a row outside Great Yarmouth Library in Tolhouse Street. Norwich Crown Court heard Hetherington and others were arrested a short while later at an address nearby. Oliver Haswell, prosecuting, said Hetherington was found to have hidden a rather scary combat knife with an 18-centimetre blade inside a washing machine. The knife was recovered by police, but could not be forensically linked to the earlier stabbing, which Hetherington would be bound to face no further action for. Mr. Haswell said Hetherington told police he carried the knife for his own protection, although he had not removed it from the inside of his gilet. Hetherington also told police he had been going round robbing drug dealers, taking their cocaine off them. He said they had taken more than one bag of cocaine from more than one drug dealer between September the 7th and the 10th, 2023, although did not mention who else was involved. Hetherington, of Chaucer Road, Yarmouth, has 47 convictions for 85 previous offences. He appeared at court on Tuesday, December the 17th, after admitting conspiracy to commit robbery. He also admitted possession of a bladed article in Tolhouse Street, Yarmouth. Imposing a 34-month sentence, Judge Catherine Moore said his previous offending made grim reading, indicating he had a violent streak and an inclination to carry weapons. She said he was to tell police he had been, with others, going around robbing drug dealers and taking their cocaine. She said his offending was more serious because of the history and the fact that he had not mended his ways. She said in order to turn away from crime, he needed to be drug-free, sober and in gainful employment. Stephen Mather, mitigating, said he had spent a significant amount of time in custody and was now drug-free. He said Hetherington planned to open his own barbers and had employment in groundworks lined up when he was released from prison, adding the defendant was significantly motivated to make changes in his life. A rogue manhole in Gorston has been shaking homes and rattling nerves. For the last 9 months, residents of Beccles Road have endured vibrating homes and sleepless nights, thanks to the loose utility cover that clangs with every passing truck. Ben Sewell, 36, whose house is closest to the noisy culprit, said, "When trucks drive over the manhole, they bang the lid, and this causes his house to shake." He first reported the issue to Norfolk County Council in April this year. And yet, despite repeated complaints and inspections by engineers, the metallic clanging persists. Mr. Sewell, who works in the building industry, said, "It wakes me up. You can feel it when you're going to bed. You can hear it when you're sitting on your sofa. I'm getting woken up at 4 a.m. by Arctic trucks going over. I can even feel it vibrating my bed when I'm lying there, and that's bad. They've had all summer to sort it out. The manhole cover is absolutely knackered," he said. A spokesman for the county council said, This cover contains telecommunications cables and is not owned by Norfolk County Council. We have served notice on BT to repair it, but they have passed ownership to another provider. A further notice has now been issued and we are presently awaiting a response. We appreciate any noise disturbance can be frustrating, but it does not pose any risk to highway users. James Carter, who also lives on the road, said, "It's a massive metallic clanging sound. You get vibrations from vehicles." Attempts to find out who was responsible for the manhole, however, have been a bit of a nightmare. "Highways should be responsible," Mr. Carter said. "We just need somebody to take ownership of it." And this is a creepy story, so if you don't like spiders, block your ears. One of Britain's largest spiders is thriving in Norfolk, as thousands are now thought to be lurking in the county. The Fen Raft spider was brought back from the brink of extinction thanks to a successful breeding programme. The RSPB said there are now potentially 3,750 females at Mid-Year Nature Reserve on the Norfolk Broads after the spider was introduced in 2012. A striking ambush predator with a dark body and cream stripes down the side, it can have a leg span of up to 8 centimetres and a body the size of a small mouse. Oh my word! The spider hunts its prey on the water's surface and has been helped by introductions to new sites and managing grazing marshes to suit the very rare arachnids. The resurgence of the spider has been named as one of the RSPB's major nature wins of 2024. It's highlighted some of the successes secured this year to show what can be achieved with conservation efforts. RSPB Chief Executive Betty Spates said, "This year has secured major nature wins, from the historic sand eel fishing closure to saving species like saiga antelope from extinction. The RSPB has demonstrated what can be achieved through vital conservation efforts." A seafront venue is promising a huge New Year's Eve party with confetti, balloons and a spectacular countdown. The Empire on Marine Parade in Great Yarmouth is set to end its season with a bang. Headlining the night will be the Alternative Jukebox, a popular local rock band that is played regularly at the Empire. Frontman Dave Rivers said, "The Empire is one of the best venues in the county, with top sound and lights. We can't wait to rock a full house this New Year's Eve." The event will feature live music, crowd karaoke sing-alongs, and a midnight countdown complete with confetti and balloons. Project Director Jack Jay said, "This is one of the best nights of the year, and I believe the biggest New Year's Eve party around. Advance tickets are selling out fast, so we're urging people to grab them quickly. Street food vendors will serve gourmet burgers and pizzas until 9 p.m. The party marks the Empire's final night before its seasonal closure, with plans to reopen at Easter 2025. Tickets are available online at Ticket Tailor.
Well, we've not heard from Desney yet, so here she is with a piece from one of her favourites, Pam Ayres.
It was Christmas Eve on a Friday. The shops were full of cheer, with tinsel in the windows and presents twice as dear. 1,000 Father Christmases sat in their little huts, and folks was buying crackers and folks was buying nuts. All up and down the country, before the lights were snuffed. Turkeys, they got murdered, and cockerels, they got stuffed. Christmas cakes got marzipaned, and puddings, they got steamed. Mothers, they got desperate, and tired kiddies screamed. hundredweights of Christmas cards went flying through the post, with first-class stamps on those you had to flatter most. Within a million kitchens, mince pies was being made. On everybody's radio, White Christmas, it was played. Out in the frozen countryside, men crept round on their own, hacking off the holly what other folks had grown. Mistletoe from willow trees was by a man wrenched clear, so he could kiss his neighbour's wife he'd fancied all the year. And out upon the hillside, where the Christmas trees had stood, all was completely barren, but for little stumps of wood. The little trees that flourished all the year were there no more, but in a million homes dropped their needles on the floor. And out of every cranny, cupboard, hiding place and nook, little bikes and kiddies' trikes were secretively took. Yards of wrapping paper was rustled round about, and bikes were wheeled to bedrooms with the pedals sticking out. Rolled up in Christmas paper, the action men were tensed, all ready for the morning when their fighting life commenced, with Tommy guns and daggers all clustered round about. "Peace on earth, goodwill to men," the figures seemed to shout. The church was standing empty, the pub was standing packed. There came a yell, "Noel, Noel," and glasses, they got cracked. From up above the fireplace, Christmas cards began to fall, and trodden on the floor said, "Merry Christmas to you all." "And Merry Christmas to you too. And try and see through all that cynicism, and remember the importance of what you have today, and family and friends. Happy Christmas, everyone."
Christ is born in Bethlehem.
another from the James Paget Choir, and See Amid the Winter Snow. Still a bit thin on the ground around here. Well, we're getting quite close to the end of this year's Christmas marathon, but I can remind you that there will be an edition next week, but online only at first. But we will add it to the USB stick the next week, so our postal listeners don't miss out. Well, from all of us here at Grapevine, have a great Christmas and a very happy new year. And I have to tell you that news content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Your newsreader next week will be Andy. But in the meantime, from all at Grapevine, have a great Christmas and a very happy new year. As usual, we leave the last words to Dusty.
Well, Christmas is upon us once again. I cannot believe where this year has gone. But Christmas always brings back memories, and as I have lots of years behind me rather now than in front, I kind of equate with all sorts of things that I read. And one of the beautiful things is a description that I'll never forget from Wind in the Willows. And it just brings me back to my days in the police force when we used to go on duty at the Christmas week because the people who had families would like to be with their children. So it was always us who used to plod the streets. And I just feel that this description really sums up how I used to feel on, say, Christmas night or Boxing Day early in the morning. The rapid nightfall of mid-December had quite beset the little village as they approached it on soft feet over a first thin fall of powdery snow. Little was visible but squares of a dusky orange-red on either side of the street, where the firelight or lamplight of each cottage overflowed through the casements into the dark world without. Most of the low latticed windows were innocent of blinds, and to the lookers in from outside, the inmates gathered round the tea table, absorbed in handiwork, or talking with laughter and gesture, had each that happy grace which is the last thing the skilled actor shall capture, the natural grace which goes with perfect unconsciousness of observation. Moving at will from one theatre to another, the two spectators, so far from home themselves, had something of wistfulness in their eyes as they watched a cat being stroked, a sleepy child picked up and huddled off to bed, or a tired man stretch and knock out his pipe on the end of a smouldering log. I think that's a beautiful description of a Christmas Eve or night, and I like to leave that one with you to think about. Now I'm going to move on to something which is very important to our listeners, and of course that is listening. If you can't see terribly well, your senses of listening are often heightened, aren't they? And this little poem is called Listening to Christmas. Have you ever heard snow? Not the howling wind of a blizzard, not the crackling of snow underfoot, but the actual falling of snow. We heard it one night in Wisconsin, quite unexpectedly, while walking up a hill toward our cabin in the woods, a soft whisper between footsteps. We stopped, switched off our flashlights, and just listened. All around us in the darkness, we heard the gentle fall of snow on snow. No wind, no sound, but the snow. Have you ever heard Christmas? Not the traffic noises in the city, not the bells and hymns and carols, beautiful as they are, not even the laughter of your children as they open their presents, but Christmas itself? Have you ever been by yourself and just sat and listened to the silence within, patiently, without letting the mind race to the next Christmas chore? Perhaps if you have, you felt the pulse of all humanity beating in your own heart. Perhaps you noticed an outflowing of love for all your brothers and sisters on the earth, a soft sense of oneness with all that lives. In the silence of a snowy night, listen intently, holding your breath, and you may hear snow on snow. Serene, alone, undisturbed by thought, listen to the silence in your heart, and you may hear Christmas. As always, I leave you all with a little blessing from all of us at Grapevine. It's always been such a pleasure and a privilege to read for you, to bring you stories, and we wish you the true peace of Christmas as always. So may the simplicity of the shepherds, the perseverance of the wise men, the joy of the angels, the love of the Christ child fill the hearts and homes of all of you and those you love at this holy season and throughout the year to come. And as we say good night, we wish you all a happy Christmas and a peaceful and healthy new year.